The topic for the evening is creative deprivation or creatively depriving. Before we start, I'm new to this role. I'd like you to know what my understanding of my role is so we can see each other well. A philosopher in this village, as I understand it, is not one who spouts and all that, but asks questions and tries to keep questions bouncing back and forth. So that'll be mostly my role. We'll start on time. If we haven't finished, when we finish, we'll finish. If we haven't finished by 10:15, we'll take a break so those who want it to go can leave. So that'll be part of my job. But other than that, we'll just try to share back and forth. Building on the premise that I understand was done quite well last evening by our good director in talking about all of us being special people. Tonight there are no specialists in the room, and probably this week there won't be, and maybe this year there won't be really any specialists at the village. This time we're really counting on each other to have something to say, something to share, something to question. So all of us are specialists on creative deprivation. John announced it in terms of things that we might be able to give up to live a healthier, saner, more lively life. Are you willing to make a statement that says whether you're able to do that and where? Other than moaning.
I think taking on what Al said this morning in talking about energy, that our use of energy, our lifestyle is absolutely idolatrous, and we use energy because we can't find anything creative or meaningful or worthwhile to do with our life, so we look for more and more and different ways of doing things and faster ways of doing things and more gadgets, and I think just in that sense, because the way we live is idolatrous, that we tend not to be creative at all anymore. We want things done for us. Anything that's faster is better. That's an illusion that we live under. To sit still is to waste time. Is an illusion. That's what I'm throwing out.
Steve. Anyone? Yep. Yeah.
I think perhaps all of the things that I need to give up are going to require a change of heart, not just a change of lifestyle, but maybe even a whole change of heart. And I think maybe one of the things that would help in this change of heart would be to give up predictability, to give up knowing in advance all that I got coming to me. That way I think maybe I could be more open to change. But as long as I have expectations, I'm not going to change.
It's legitimate, by the way, if you don't understand what someone is saying, to ask them to say more or less or explain to you. Also,
thanks a lot.
that was an introduction to what I was going to say.
Rich, you mean like give up tenure?
I gave that up 4 times, and they finally gave it to me when I was away in Africa. But that's exactly what I mean.
Or like a retirement plan, or like what? I mean, that's what I think of when I think of sort of guaranteed expectations. Mm-hmm. I look ahead, it's like a retirement plan.
Inflation doesn't guarantee you much.
Couldn't hear.
Didn't hear what you said, Al.
I said with inflation, a retirement plan doesn't guarantee you much. You know, 10 years, it'll be worth half of what it's worth. 20 years, it'll be worth a quarter of what it's worth. That's where your faith is. I don't like the idea of giving up. I guess I think you got to create something that's so joyful that you don't need a lot of things. It's like Holden when you're up here. Of course, you know, you can do a lot of things you do in the city. But I know some Christmases people bring up presents here, even though it's really, you know, against the spirit of our Christmas. But you don't need anything here much. To exist with joy. You got friends, you got play, you got recreation, you got stimulation, and all this stuff going on. So deprivation, I think we need a new lifestyle which is so rich and joyful that most of what we now spend money for, going out to eat and traveling all over and so forth, just seems like it's too tame in comparison, too empty.
There are an awful lot of people who cannot afford to come here.
So,
this is not a cheap place to come to. No, I mean, as far as the existing together, I agree what you're saying about creating. But I think in being able to create, you have to be able to move away from some of the things that make it now impossible for you to do that.
Well, hopefully you can do this in the city. That's certainly what we're trying to do in our church and our covenantal community, is to move this way right in the midst of the world. That little moment right here. Which will just not require the same amount of stuff and things. You only have to pay $15 to see a play. You'll put it on location, and you may think you got to get so sophisticated, I suppose. We'll do it ourselves.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that we talk about deprivation. I agree with what Allison and I agree with what Rich is saying, because when we turn it around, what is it that we want to deprive ourselves of? It's all useless stuff when we think about it. It has very little meaning. And the idea of expectations and things, I had a television set and then it died and I put it away and I didn't have one for 3 years and I forgot about what it means to be bombarded with all kinds of things. And my father just could not believe that I didn't have a television set, so he kept offering it and offering it and offering it, and I finally took it. And now I sit and look at it, and I remember how much I'm bombarded by that stuff. But it's all so pointless and useless that depriving myself of that is almost beyond even thinking about. It's, how can I deprive myself of something that has no meaning to me at all? And yet, as you look at that, you get expectations. You start thinking, I need this kind of toilet paper. I buy things now again because they have a name on them or whatever, which is the most minor example in the world. But we still have to think about depriving ourselves of things because of where we sit and what comes at us.
I think one of the things that maybe ties in with what Rich was saying, though, is we can sort of have all kinds of global expectations and everything, but when you don't buy that toilet paper or that new car or whatever, what happens to the guy who's making the toilet paper and making the car? In other words, it's going to be a long, hard, drawn-out process just by the nature of the fact that you just can't cut off all those people who, for instance, can't come to Holden immediately. You know, they're stuck in Detroit, or they're stuck in these various places. But, they depend upon that expectation psychology to make a living, just like all of us. You know, I paid $8 to come up the boat on the boat. And if I hadn't had the $8, I wouldn't have got on the boat. And I think maybe that's what Rich was saying about it's not cheap to come to Holden, or you can think of all kinds of examples like that.
Please.
It seems to me in this discussion that an assumption has been made that deprivation is good. And I would raise that as a question. You know, how do we arrive at the assumption that depriving ourselves is a good that we should be striving for?
Would you be interested in making a comment about it as to get that rolling?
Well, I think that it's, or as I have thought about this whole subject, I think it's very difficult to arrive at that assumption depriving myself is good, because the kind of things we're talking about, it's a very complex world, and balances are very delicate, and every change we make, every move we make, affects someone else negatively or positively. And it seems to me that we need to do a little thinking beyond just grabbing onto an assumption that deprivation is going to solve all of our problems. It's going to create a beautiful world. I'd like some talk about how that's going to happen. I'm not so sure.
Your question at the moment is to examine whether people in the room, some people in the room, think it's good or not. And then perhaps go on how, well, that implies, I guess, how it happens too. But try to keep focused on that aspect for a moment. Does anyone want to comment? Please.
Well, we're assuming that we live in a land of plenty and that we have things to deprive ourselves of. And there was a time in the history when there wasn't anything to deprive yourself of because you worked to keep yourself alive.
Okay.
Well, I think we can deprive ourselves, and I think it'd have value, as value is for ourselves. I don't think we have to show the great concern about protecting another person's livelihood. If we do that, what we're doing is maintaining a status quo in society. We're saying, we've got to have this society the way it is, or it's all going to get unbalanced and everything will go to pot. But we will level it even. Yes, we might get hurt ourselves as well as someone else to some degree, but it would change as the supply and demand type of thinking changes. But we can't maintain a status quo. We've got to go in a direction, and the direction we're going to go anyway is probably some kind of deprivation. It may not be serious, it may be serious, but I don't think we can say we've got to protect other people or else there's no mobility. We're going to stay, or think we're going to stay even. We're not anyway. We think we're not.
So now, please.
It's interesting, too, how cultures describe or tell what deprivation really is. The Chinese look very deprived to us because they don't have running water, because they don't have an indoor bathroom. But they sure look happier than the Americans who are living in million-dollar flats, who've got everything. So I think where you're sitting, we say they're deprived. To us, they are deprived, but they don't think they're deprived.
Well, I think rather than using deprived, if the change of value, what a change in our lifestyle perhaps, but to determine what is best for us and what we really want out of life. We don't, a lot of us get to the place where some of these things that we've lived with all this time no longer suit our purpose, or do we feel that it is for our common good. And so we change rather than necessarily feeling deprived about it.
Yes.
I think the gentleman's question about the prior question still needs to be answered tonight. I've been
question about who's to say that it is a good thing to deprive, that deprivation is a valid goal to seek after. I think it is, and I think that there are truly answers to his question that ought to be probably mentioned first.
Want to try?
Well, yeah. I guess the sheer necessity in terms of the consumption of the natural resources that are available. Now that we have to, whether we think it's a good thing or not, we'll have to sooner or later. Our physical well-being, we ought to deprive ourselves before the belt won't fit anymore, or whatever, too much cholesterol or hundreds of things. And then there's the theological aspect too, our concern for the peoples of the world and our consumption of the earth's resources, so that as a result of it, others will be unnecessarily deprived because of our greed or whatever. Just some part of an answer to the gentleman's question, I think.
Is it Phil?
Yeah.
Phil, does that begin to meet your question, or make you feel good? But is it?
I wish somebody could kind of draw a picture of what that means, because I think it's a whole lot bigger than we're ready to face.
Can you say more about that?
Well, once you start, you're talking about change, and once you start making change in a certain direction, it's hard to stop. And the example of that is, how did we get where we are today? We started on a course of change, and once you start moving in that direction, of automation, industrialization, it's hard to stop. And I would argue that once we start on this course of change, we need to know where we're going. I think it would affect a tremendous change, for example, in our position in the world. The whole balance of power, we're talking about that. And I'm not personally afraid, or I don't think that the United States has to sit in control of the whole world. But somebody is going to be in control. And,
that's a really interesting example that you bring up. It's because of our inability to deprive ourselves of, let's say, oil, that we are rapidly in a position of losing our place in the world. The dollar crisis, I haven't heard much about it this summer because I've been up here, but the dollar crisis, the weakening of America's financial situation is directly related to the fact that we are out of balance in our foreign exchange. And the reason we're out of balance is because we're importing oil at a rate that not only depletes that resource for the world, but is prodigally consumed by us here. So we are weakening our position in the world because of our inability. Carter knows, most economists know, most businessmen and industrialists know that we simply can't go on, but we don't know what it's going to take. Right now what's happening is that people who go abroad are simply incapable any longer of functioning abroad as Americans. Our money is worthless, and or increasingly so. So if we just want to use that as an argument, the point you're raising, it would be, let's do with less so that we can maintain a position. I wouldn't want to use that as an argument. I was thinking of things like, what would really happen to Johnny Carson if we all stopped watching The Tonight Show? How could he possibly survive on less than $2.5 million a year? I mean, I really think it would create great economic hardship for us to have half of that, or a fourth of that, or one-tenth of that, you know. I would be delighted to live one-tenth of that. And so I would like to start creatively by depriving Johnny Carson of an audience for what is really not... It was really very trivial stuff anyway, and who knows, it might even be good for him.
There's a nice paradox here, because as we use more energy, we have more blackouts, and there's less chance to watch TV.
Rudy had his hand up.
Maybe we could focus on one particular thing, depriving or changing the mode of transportation. In other words, if you think of people movers rather than individual movers in terms of getting from one place to the other, we all had to travel to get here. Now, if we cooperatively seek out ways in which many people are moved by the same amount of energy rather than one person, and being from California, I am well accustomed to driving the freeways and seeing only one person in a car. And if it's two, it's something unusual. And three is an abnormal situation. And people don't want to change that. And can we, or are we willing to deprive ourselves of some convenience? And really, it's a convenience. It no longer can be classed as a necessity. We could have people movers that really take care of a lot of people, trains, buses, and all kinds of things, other than individuals driving their own car. And if you just think about that one area, is it a deprivation? And how serious is it? Maybe we get acquainted with some new people if we cooperatively shared transportation.
Interesting, in our area they've just tried that. You know, last year RTA is sending buses all over the suburbs now instead of only in the city. And my observation is that they have 3 to 4 people riding any one time. So the answer, again, I guess what we're talking about is how do we get to the point of committing ourselves to do that? Because the offer is right there. It's refused so far. Somebody else said, yes.
This summer we had the opportunity of entertaining a nephew from Spain who was 15, and an opportunity of entertaining a Norwegian who came visiting, a young Norwegian in his early 20s. And both of the young men made the same comment. My goodness, but you people, oh no, there's a lot of fat people here. Why are they so fat?
Yeah.
Now maybe there's some creative deprivation we can put into that somewhere. It's an observation made by a 15-year-old boy.
My question is, who tells whom that you are to be deprived? Again, being out of America for 5 years, and I see Americans differently now, would the typical American who doesn't come to Holden, I don't see you people as what I read about in Time Magazine, you're different. The typical American, would they, the Archie Bunker, would he adhere to a government saying you have to ride the bus, that you cannot eat, you know, will they clear your shelves? I can't believe going into a grocery store and seeing 7 different brands of Pampers, of disposable diapers, but yet who can tell an American you cannot have 7, you must only have 1 brand? The communists do it very well in China, and they live a deprived life, again, as I was saying before. But their whole attitude toward what life is about, what makes them happy, is completely different. And I can't see too many Americans, you know, somebody saying, this, you're going to be deprived, and is it going to be a government? Is it going to be a church? Who's going to tell the typical American to be deprived?
Yeah.
Well, I'm bothered by us talking about anybody except ourselves in the whole conversation.
in terms of what we see as the kind of cultural impositions of purchasing of goods and services in the way of life, which we now perceive personally as not as depriving. In other words, I would put it the other way. I see the cultural imposition of the need for expensive services and goods, and I think particularly what Paul will have to go through in terms of meeting his peers, having goods and services, that is a great deprivation to me and to my family, in the sense that it doesn't give me the freedom to live the kind of a life and to have the kind of values. By that I mean it forces me, when you think of $8,000 for a year of schooling, just the whole notion somehow that is a creative thing in our society. I know it's ambiguous, but it seems to me that we have to find a way of life where you don't need to send your kids to a high-powered Christian college, because you have a way of life in your own community, in your own church, which makes that very unnecessary. You can go and milk a state school, or you can go without the education. I mean, what are we going to do with all the PhDs that aren't going to have jobs anyway? All our kids, we're going to push them into that rat race. Erling Jorsen said, he wouldn't go through the rat race again and get his PhD. I don't know whether I would or not, but I'm quoting Erling, I think correctly. But what I'm trying to say is that we should talk about what we experience as depriving us of a real, meaningful, whole existence, which we ought to eliminate. And then we begin to get at our own existence is something we can do something about. Well, it's not that I'm against the government imposing 27.5 miles per gallon, even 40 miles per gallon on our cars. I believe it ought to, but it won't, probably. And what do we do ourselves? What are the things that bother us? Now, I'm really bothered by education that requires the same amount of money. And in our community, I hope we have a one-room school room, probably, and we won't have to worry about it. And I have our own college, probably. And we probably have more better educated people asking more serious questions than come out of most other places. I know it's ambiguous. I don't have any formula. I'm just saying, I am very, very upset by the thought of raising a family in our culture with expensive services, which to not to have, we would feel deprived. We would feel deprived. Most people would feel deprived, in the sense of which I don't think I would feel deprived. I think I would feel free if I didn't have to buy all the stuff to keep up with all the stuff. I don't know what I'm making.
Okay. Do you want to focus on that, what Al's raising? Huh? About that aspect.
I think maybe one of the things that I hear Al saying that points to at least some of the problems that I personally have might be the need for community. I find living on a street unrelated to my neighbors, that each of us has exactly the same thing. Each of us has, I mean, we don't have that long a block, but I bet you we got 40 lawnmowers. I know that we've got, everybody except us has two cars. Everybody's got a refrigerator, and most of us have an extra freezer. And I think maybe the reason for all of that accumulation of stuff on one block is because we don't know each other. That it may be, I don't think deprivation is good. I think creative deprivation is excellent. And I think that the creative part may come, like I see what Al and Paul are trying to do, build a community around commonality, something that you have in common. It can be your faith, it can be your lifestyle, whatever it is,
But I find it impossible to deprive myself of anything by myself.
Would anybody else be willing to share what it is that stands in the way, if you wanted to creatively deprive yourself? What stands in the way? What keeps you from doing?
I think peer pressure.
Say
peer,
more.
Peer
say,
pressure.
Want to say more about that?
Not really.
Oh, okay.
Well, you know, you live in a certain neighborhood, and if your children's playmates are going to the community pool, well, then you're pressured into buying a membership into the pool. You're pressured into having your child join the swim team because his friend Johnny is. You're pressured into joining a country club because your business associates wish to have you join so that you can do advertising for the company. And I can just go on and on and on.
But haven't you pushed yourself into that predicament? I mean, you can say no, can't you?
Now, why don't you say how you said
no? Well, yeah. I mean, just because my friend is on the swim team doesn't push my mother to be used to the swim team. I mean, that doesn't really...
It hasn't done it. You have really faced these decisions.
Yes, I mean, it's like saying that since my brother is involved in something, that my parents should pressure me into that, or something like that. And I don't think that they have to, and I don't think that, I mean, it's their responsibility.
I think Al is asking, where's some place that you have said no to peers? Personally, not your parents, but you.
I think a lot of the social aspects, like when my friends do something that I don't approve of, and I can say no, and I can feel good about it, and do my own thing.
Is peer pressure, that's the whole thing that's keeping us in it? Go ahead.
Lack of commitment, I guess I can only speak for myself. Mm-hmm. Without sounding judgmental, we like it. I like it the way it is. In our parish, we've done a little bit with this whole infant formula thing. You know, who wants to battle the Nestle Corporation, American Home Products, etc.? You know, they, in a sense, are dictating what the third world people should have. That if they don't have their infant formula, they are being deprived of what we have. And actually, it's a very immoral thing. I don't know how many of you are into that. And then, so we say, well, we in our parish paper we put out, okay, this is what you can do. And nobody seems to give a damn. This is what it amounts to, as far as who wants to be that committed to go and to go to their local store, whether it's Red Owl or whatever it might be, and say, hey, let's knock off promoting Nestle or American Home Product stuff and make that kind of a personal commitment. I don't do it. Other than, you know, writing some articles in the very years of the year, do it. You know. And then you get it. Again, I guess it bothers me. I've had people from Holden, this is our first time out here, have come back, and man, they're really fired about the Holden lifestyle, and why can't we do more of that in our own parish? It's not very realistic, I don't think. At least where I'm sitting. But, and in so many of our groups, whether it's social concerns or social ministry, we get all fired up and we have maybe an Indian Concern Sunday. It's a one-shot thing, and then it's dropped until it rolls around next year. And in so many of these areas, and it's sort of like, you know, Don Quixote battling the windmill. It's frustrating, and that's sort of where I'm at. And I see a lack of commitment on my own part to do something really about it as far as this whole depriving.
I'm still curious why that isn't realistic. Why did you say it's not very realistic? Why isn't it realistic to try to live like that there?
Yeah, I guess I speak again only for myself.
Yeah, well, that's,
what is that?
What is that?
Where is that? Where is
it? Well, I live in a fat cat neighborhood in Mendota Heights in St. Paul. And you know, everybody likes what they're doing. They're not ready to start giving up and becoming a community. We're pushing it, but it's a slow process.
Everybody likes it.
Please.
For me, there's also some confusion of knowledge. At Christmas, all of our friends were getting microwaves. And I was hit with this. Well, it saves a lot of energy, you know, the whole bit versus the traditional oven. I think we're into that with sugar now, with research coming out. We just got hit with it this last week on smoking. You know, certain brands, low tower, hey, they're okay. And to me, you know, it's really hard to come up with something that's so simplistic that I can say, I can deprive myself of this and it will be the right decision.
Okay.
Never be. You just go. See, it's better than other things.
And what we're doing, though, is asking different people what's keeping them. Go ahead.
I'd like to respond over here to the comment that it's difficult to find enough commitment to write or to boycott the Nestle company or whoever. And I would argue that here we are again. If that's difficult, how are we going to get to this guy? That's what's tough. You know, the Nestle company, I'm not going to lose my job. I won't lose a nickel if I boycott the Nestle company. But, you know, if we're really serious about the energy crisis, why don't we talk about not having any car and only going where I can go on my bicycle like many folks do in the rest of the world?
But you're putting the rest of the world, I think, maybe, but his comment was apropos, is that I don't think you can say, well, you know, those Chinese or those Indians are, you know, they aren't riding around in Cadillacs or Volkswagens even, and therefore, you know, our situation is really, you know, sort of, if we could adjust in the same fashion, I think, you know, historically, you can't just decide we're going to cut ourselves out right here and put ourselves in a geographical area, another culture, everything.
Well, we're talking about a cupboard that exists for the world, it seems to me, that's running empty. And it doesn't matter where we are, you know. We're in the world together.
The world is a great big different place, and you know, that's what I said. I my first comment was that I don't think we can be so global in our expectations. I think, you know, we've got to make adjustments that are fitted. I mean, if we make if we have those expectations, I think we're going to fall so far short that we're going to say, it wasn't worth the effort, so who gives a damn, and we'll go back. And I think we've done that a few times. I mean, instance of that, you can, don't have to look very far. It seems like we, you know, I'm sure everyone's been involved in an enterprise where, you know, the original expectation was so great, and what came out of it wasn't enough to keep the impetus going. It just died. I think one of the things that keeps us in the boat we're in is the fear of the future. When he said that inflation is going to eat up your pension or whatnot, I think that's why you're going to lay out $8,000 for a college education for a year. I can't imagine myself doing that.
Yeah, but it doesn't give you that much more income today. Maybe, you know, statistics show that you lose as much income if you didn't go to college. If you think about income.
I'd like to come ahead. From Austin. I'm Mendota Heights. I live in Minneapolis myself, and we are plenty deprived in the winter. Therefore, an additional deprivation is hard to put upon people. That's one point. The other one is the only way we can start is in a very small community of people who are like-minded. And so if, let's say, more people go to home and come back and are convinced that there is an alternative, maybe two or three families together, and see a support system to start. Because you really can't go knocking on doors and say, hey, don't. As an example, then you can have friendship groups,
have it grow in that way.
There's another hand over here, Miss, somewhere. Please.
I hate to deprive myself because it's too convenient to have my own refrigerator, my own washer and dryer, my own car. Much too convenient.
Please.
I go right along with that. We moved to the United States from Canada a few years ago, and I didn't ever feel deprived there. And I haven't felt deprived living here. And I find living in the Pacific Northwest is extremely exciting. And there are all kinds of things I want to do and explore. And having a car gives me the freedom to do that. And I don't feel any peer pressure for an automobile whatsoever. I want an automobile so I can go to the library and pick up films to show my kids at school the next morning, because if I don't have the car, you know, I can't do them. And I find that my wants and desires are really, I feel, dictated by that. And I...
Do you buy a car to get 50 miles on the gallon?
Oh, well, we have a very old one, and as long as it goes, yeah, they were not buying.
Well, it's a very, very practical issue, and cramp yourself. We were certainly trying to come across from Chicago with all the stuff in a Toyota. Or do you buy a big car? Which, I mean, that's, you face the issues. Now, the first time we got the little car, we decided, instead of what we used to do, is take vacation, go to Florida, fly, we took our little car, and we couldn't get very far, and we didn't go very fast, so we got to the Spokane and had a wonderful time. It turned out to be a great gift. We had a little car and we wanted to use very little money in terms of transportation, very little energy and so forth. It turned out to be a great gift. And I think that's the kind of thing that in my experience happens over and over again. That some of these things that seem like deprivation of gifts, I'd like to see us think more of the gifts of operating in ways which use less goods, less services, and how does that become a gift? This is really a gift to us.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you were here.
Wait, she brings up a question in my mind is, are we speaking of a uniform deprivation of everyone in society the same way? Everyone does not have a car, everyone does not have this or that. Or are we still speaking of personal? And if we were, I would say deprivation really is concerns needs. She's doing very well, I think, with her used car because of all the energy it takes to go buy a new car, that sort of thing, as far as for her needs to explore this area. I have given up my electric lawn tools and have substituted and bought used lawnmower and everything. I'm back to the old way. Not because I like to do it so much, maybe, but because my needs are that I have to keep physically fit. So I want to go back to all the hand methods. I'm getting away from all my machinery altogether. But that's, I think, a deprivation to someone else. I could be doing it without really depriving myself of anything, doing myself some good. Yet, it is a deprivation. It's not what I had before. It would be, you know, sort of a step down, so to speak. But that's, I think, deprivation, but according to my needs. And I think maybe that's the area we might be dealing with more than a thought that everyone in the country must be uniform.
Yes?
It just seems to me that we have so much that we no longer look at things as gifts anymore. We come with our bigger and bigger basket and say, God, fill this up, and it's no longer, we don't think of things as gifts or receive them with joy. And an example in our family was 4 years ago, I think we were living on, what, 1,400? The year, the sixth in the family, and the kids for Christmas, their big gift was a six-pack of soda because we just thought that was something we could do without. And you can't imagine kids getting excited over a six-pack of Cokes under the tree, but they really were. And I, you know, I think it's kind of like ice cream at Holden when we have a Spumoni. Once a week, everybody gets really excited because normally desserts aren't exciting because we just have them every time and we come to expect them. And I think, again, it depends on your ability to see differently, and see what's going to free you up, see what is a justice issue, separate your needs from your greed, you know, deal with your needs, and if everybody can make a list for themselves, and then deprive yourself of that which you don't need, to me that's what creative deprivation is. It's being able to celebrate something that you do have instead of just having so much that there's no longer any celebration in my life at all. And it also, to me, is not giving my kids things before they're even asking for them. I see little kids at Christmas getting 12 and 14 gifts and they rip open everything and they play with the boxes and could care less when it gets to the 10th or 11th gift. I don't think that's good for the kids, and a parent that gives their child lessons on absolutely everything there is to give them on, from swimming to soccer to handball to trumpet, and takes them every place because they've never been there and they're only 10 years old, you know, what is there to look forward to in life? I think that's not being a very good parent, because I think then kids have to ask. They think things have to be given for them, and they never learn to entertain themselves or learn to be creative.
Yeah, our own need to be doing that to our children is probably the strongest factor. Ignoring anything about them. Our need to be that giving, as we see it, person that plies them with all these things, bespeaks more messed up stuff inside of ourselves.
The question was asked a little bit earlier about who's going to tell the average American to deprive himself of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then to come up with a, will the government do it? Earlier this evening, I heard someone describe how the government in Ohio instructed the people to turn their thermostats down last winter to a certain point and listed in sequence which groups of homes or industries or recreational would be denied the right to have fuel. unless we can come up with creative deprivation, we'll get whatever form the government will impose upon us if we let it get to that point. And we've had not only the illustration in Ohio, but that sort of thing is cropping up around the world, around our country. And if you drove here, you had lots of reminders of it along the highway, 55 miles per hour. You know, there will be more and more of that, and the less we do it ourselves, the more and more it will be imposed upon us, and then it doesn't have to be too creative.
Yes.
Part of the problem, too, is the insidiousness of the system, which in Chicago, as you know, Elmer, maybe I don't know if it's in other parts of the country, but a food chain that has what they call a grand bazaar, which is basically the largest grocery store you've ever seen in your life. It's a warehouse where you pick things out a lift truck, practically, because of the quantity that they have, and yet you go there because everything you buy there is cheaper. And so you save your money by participating in this system that inundates us with not seven brands of Pampers, but 15 brands of Pampers, which can go from the cheapest you've ever seen to the most expensive you've ever seen. And so the system now is turning on us when we're trying to make ourselves live more simply, more cheaply, more easily, or better. It turns on us and says, okay, we will make it bigger for you then, and that way it'll be cheaper. And so the insidiousness of the system means that we have to fight even harder, as Mary said, for ourselves. In some ways, I walk into one of those places, as I have, and I can't fight Jewel food stores. I can't fight them except by not walking in their doors. I can't fight Johnny Carson except by not turning him on. Personal choice, again, is the only thing any of us can do on some levels.
Please.
I think one thing too, if anybody gets anything out of hold in it, I think it should be the ability to walk away gratefully, accepting the responsibility of living a life worthy of emulation. If we're the ones that can afford to come here, then we're the ones that people are going to want to imitate. And I don't think we have to worry about changing the world. If we can do it in our own homes with our own families as a start, you know, we shouldn't be paralyzed by feeling everything has to change right before our eyes like magic.
Well, you can make an inventory of what you have in your home and your family and your desires and your leisures and your whether you're going to throw your socks away or whether you're going to mend them and whether you're going to throw your sheets away with one hole or whether you're going to mend them until you've got six mends on them and sewed them and two sheets together. And there's lots of ways can be saved, money can be saved, or you can do without things. But I'm not going to tell somebody else in their life what they're going to have to do without. That's their choice.
But why does it always have to be monetary? I still think that this has to come from within us, and the change is not necessarily monetary that's important. It can frequently be a change in our lifestyle or a change of our principles or a change of other qualities that are far more important than the monetary aspect. It's important too, but the other things are, and it has to start with me. You can't start with the whole community.
Could you illustrate something there that would show what you mean?
Well, perhaps I can. I'm a nurse, and I've worked for many years in the, quote, established way of nursing. And through a series of circumstances, 2 years ago, I went to work for a nutritionist. And as a result of this, our lifestyle has changed considerably, because I am learning, have learned, that the things that we have come to feel is important in our lives, you know, the dessert she talks about, etc., are really very harmful to us. The things that are important to us are really quite basic, and what we thought at one time we couldn't get along without, we really don't miss. But this is a personal choice that you have to make yourself, and you start with yourself. Then it can grow from there. Somebody else sees that what it has done to your health aspects, for instance, then they might choose to do the same thing. But it's a right to choose what you want yourself. And when you go to the grocery store, just because there's 15 kinds of Pampers there, you don't have to buy them. You can leave them there.
You don't have to buy any.
You can wash your own, like I always do.
Yes.
There's something also in the food we eat. You know, the people who come to Holden, that's one of the first things they notice is that the difference in the meals that are served here, and the balanced quality of the diet, and the fact that there are more grains that are used. And it's, as I understand, it's supposed to be well known that it's better for us in our digestive tract. They have to work more in digesting grains and seeds and things of that sort. And it seems that we have the impression that for proper nutrition we have to have a lot of meat. But I grew up as a vegetarian, and I lived my first 18 years without ever eating any meat of any kind. And over the last couple of years, hardly any. The thing that I think that I could give up, though, is eating out at restaurants, a lot of that. And restaurants have grown a lot into really a big industry. And I know for one, for myself, that I eat out so much that it's not something that's particularly special. Yeah. I eat out as a matter of habit, or, you know, a social activity to get together with a friend. And I think if I made it to be a simple meal at home, just to get together and make it a sharing experience, it would be more personal and less expensive. And probably eat better food, less inclined to have French fries and a greasy hamburger or something of that sort. So that's something that I feel like I could do.
The young lady right there.
I am a representative for the Northwest for Parkinson Mission, and one of the aims of Parkinson Mission is to try to raise the consciousness level of the people that we work with. And I think that this is one of the things that is going to help us help other people, is to educate people, to know what is really happening, and to raise their consciousness level about the needs of other people and how that can be done in a Christ-centered way.
Thank you.
Elmer?
Yes.
I agree with what you just said, that as long as we talk about depriving ourselves, if it ends just with ourselves, then it seems like we're missing the boat. You know, it's just a form of deprivation for the sake of deprivation or whatever. But I think that we have to somehow break through to where our deprivation is helping out somebody else.
That's right.
And then it can become a joyful thing, you know, and it can be done in the spirit of the gospel.
That's right.
And until we're able to do this with joy, then we're missing the boat. And I think the only way that it's going to be a joyful thing is to do it in the spirit of service.
That's right.
Yes?
I can think of one advantage if we do have much more than we need. Our congregation is sponsoring another refugee family, and I started calling 2-3 days ago to find donations for a 2-bedroom apartment, and within 3 days I have a 2-bedroom apartment filled with everything a family can need from a different country. So this is our
point. Elmer?
Yes.
Another thing that Rich was saying earlier about Poland being expensive for some people and they're not being able to afford it, one thing that we could do is deprive ourselves of a year coming up, or 2 years, in sponsoring senior citizen or some young people from our church whose parents cannot afford it, to send them so that they may experience what we have.
Yeah, Homer?
Yeah.
I'd like to follow up on something that Arden said a little bit ago about governmental type demands. We're from Northern California, and last year we went through a drought. And it was very important for each of us to get on the bandwagon of cutting back on our water usage. And during the course of the week, the newspapers really picked up on this. We get a paper that comes out 3 times a week. And they gave us kind of a recap of how well we were doing. And it was kind of neat because people really got behind it. And they showed pictures of all the reservoirs that were drying out and so forth. And it was a very realistic situation. The water agency, Placer County Water Agency, earns its livelihood from water usage. And the people had cut back so much that they were in a position of losing funds, not having as many funds as they had. So they put a surcharge on water usage over a certain amount to generate more income. And so people that were using, even though they had cut back on their water usage, started paying out more and more. And it's, what my point is that the governmental bodies also, this not being on a large scale, but have to be ready to meet the changes that the people are going through. And they could cut back on maybe the use of their trucks, which apparently they didn't want to. And those types of things, that they have to also be flexible if we're going to make those kinds of changes too.
You're highlighting that complexity business again, that mm-hmm. you may take some rules, but there may be other things pushing around you.
Yeah, well, I'd like to push the point too, that the government is simply us. And whatever we lay blame on the government, we really are pointing to ourselves. And we can change it. The government is ours. We are the voice, and it's up to us to get what we think should be gotten through our representatives who speak for us and act for us. If they don't act, and we think they should, then we ought to do something about it.
Yes, Bill?
I'd like to raise a kind of a cynical note. Given our knowledge of human nature, not particularly in general, but specifically my own human nature, aren't we overly optimistic talking about voluntary deprivation? Is there any evidence in the history of mankind of this kind of thing happening?
And your cynical undertone is there isn't, right?
Yes.
Okay. Somebody want to comment about that? Al?
If you go to the ecological meetings, you meet a fantastic spirit of joy and meaning. They're not very political. They're into their own things. They're into solar. They're doing simple lifestyle. They are raising their own food. They're doing all kinds of things. I find it almost a religious experience to be in those meetings. I find a lot of ex-preachers and a lot of seminarians and all kinds of people who are in that kind of thing. And they are just doing it. I mean, they have just simplified in all kinds of ways. Now, I don't know what that does for the whole culture, but there just are a lot of people moving that way. Now, I don't want to talk about other people, though. I really think we've got to talk about whether or not we can be in the right meeting. Now, I've had a great satisfaction in getting out of university and in retirement and not having the pressure of that institution. And the fact that I am retired gives me a chance to attend to my son. I never attended my other children. Now you can call that deprivation of the university with all its status and all its excitement and all its things. But it has opened up a world for me of new meanings. I call that creative withdrawal from the status activities, the money creating activities. And I get $3,000 a year as Minister of Christian Community Development. And you know, I'm in a very fortunate position because I got a little income retirement. Yeah, it's not very much really. My retirement fund now amounts to $5,000 a year. And so you know what it means in the inflation. But if we can live within the incomes that we get, a little Social Security, we'll have all the time in the world. And I think Sarah's a little bored with, you know, because she's withdrawn from the role and I've got this role in church, so I'm not bored. So I think we can work out a life, but we just don't, if we can't, we won't get caught in all the pressures of professional status, the drive to make something of yourself in a way which frequently is not too creative, but the whole culture drives you into those situations where you've got to be important, you've got to create, you've got to produce, and you get caught. Now, I don't know, I think you get relieved of that pressure and get our kids relieved of that pressure, which takes them into the high-powered university, and all the whole syndrome would be a great freeing experience. Granted, some ambiguities in it would be a great freeing experience. All I can say is it's a freeing experience for me. Maybe mine isn't typical. People always say, you've been all through it. You have it. And we've got to get ours. That's what my community tells me. You've had it, you've lived through it, but we got to go through it too. And I say, hopefully not. Hopefully we can escape most of the fragmented, technical, high-power, status-giving, money-producing roles in this country in the future. Not all of them, most of them.
Mm-hmm. I would like to respond with a little cynicism to the cynicism. How can you, in any kind of Christian context, say that you look at the average or the historical pattern and make your decision based on that? How can that be a reasonable way to do it? How can you feel like just because
look at history and it says, well, nobody ever did it before, therefore what's the point of even trying? In the Christian tradition, that seems like the most ridiculous question there is, the most ridiculous statement there is to make. Isn't the point that the individual doing it makes a difference, no matter if you can look at it historically and nobody remembers or not? We're talking about ourselves. We're talking about a decision. And to hell with history. Who cares about history? What difference does it make? We're talking about a situation in which that's something that we have to be responsible for.
That makes sense.
Our support system. The reason we can think so clearly and wisely and compassionately is that we have a support system of people who think alike. But when we go back, we're surrounded by people whose values are diametrically opposed to ours. It's very hard to sustain. So I could make a plea for a small group within the city that can help keep that vision alive.
If we start with ourselves and we're talking in the Christian context, couldn't it be argued that the churches themselves, the people of the church, have been some of the most wasteful in the use of resources?
And most denying of the gospel and all the other things, of course. But that
is our greatest glory and our deepest shame.
Yes. But we also claim that that doesn't establish whether our Lord has spoken or not.
And I guess if I were established this lifestyle of conservation, radical conservation, I would expect to try to influence my fellow man and my community, and I would believe that if it was valid, that there would be some results.
Validity and results, so seldom go together.
I would think that I could be convincing.
I don't think you judge on the basis of results, but if you have joy and satisfaction in life, it will spread.
Rudy?
Well, picking up on that same note, I feel that there ought to be some room for hope here, and if there is room for hope, it's in the education. Man, if he has been smart enough to create the system that's producing all the problems, he ought to also be smart enough and be able to educate himself to a point of extracting ourselves from this. And the question you raised about the voluntary nature of being able to do this is the basic question. Can we look far enough down the road that it's to our advantage to call it voluntary or whatever you will, but to see what's far enough ahead of us and do make the correction before you hit the wall? And if we're capable of looking into the future and understanding the trends that we are now engaged on and are pursuing are going to lead us into really a very difficult, much more difficult situation. And if we can see and judge ahead of time, man ought to be able to do this. Humankind should be smart enough to see where the problems are. And I think the first and the most hopeful thing I see is that we are talking about a problem. And if you don't recognize you have a problem, then there is no hope. But if you know you're in difficulty, then you ought to work as far ahead as you can to give yourself all the lead time there is. We're obviously going to run out of many things. And deprivation is coming. And it's a question of whether we can creatively guide the destiny of humankind to the point that we spare ourselves a lot of the agony that's down the road. And it seems to me the churches ought to be in the very cutting edge of all of this. And if there's anything we can take back from Holden, it should be a fact of an awakening that can serve as a seed in the congregation and get study groups going and really educate ourselves to what the future is. And we're hiding our head in the sand. I think we need a whole new concept of stewardship. 10% of what you earn is not stewardship. That's the question is, how about the 90%? And how have you earned that? And maybe you shouldn't have earned that. I think we need a whole new concept.
Marla?
I think the key word in this whole conversation is the word volunteer. If it's our own choice to deprive ourselves of something, it's much easier to handle than being deprived of something. I grew up during the Second World War, and I was deprived of many things. I went to bed hungry. I never had new clothes. I had my first new dress when I was 14 and I was confirmed. My first banana I ate when I was 10 and I ate it with a peel. Mm. And right now I'm glad that my children and my family are not deprived of all those things, but I'm willing to cut back in many ways and help my neighbors, like neighbors that meet in Seattle. And I still think that the volunteer part is on our side.
That's one area we really need to cut back on ourselves and make others aware of is waste. I mean, not that deprivation means like we have something that we need, but be aware of how much we're wasting and simply stop using styrofoam cups at the coffee room in the church. You can find another way. We have crystals of garbage pits just overflowing when we have to go together.
Well,
I don't want to disagree with Rudy, not in terms of his goals, but in his observation that it's intelligence that got us into the problem. It's really not. No, I think that it's entrepreneurialism, greed, what you can make by exploiting the world and other people. That's what's got us into the problem. And I think we have to recognize, therefore, that not education is the answer to that problem. Not awareness, not even looking down the road. I think we have some shocking examples of the inability of awareness to do that. Langdon Gilkey wrote a book called Shankman Compound about his experiences in a concentration, an internment camp in China in the Second World War. Rooms identical in size, one with 11 people in it, one with 9 people in it. The people in the room with 11 were crowded. The solution is obvious to everyone, but the people with 9 in the room invented all kinds of rationalizations to prevent the simple equalization. Or 100, 200 Americans got Red Cross packages, 1,500 Red Cross packages. There were 1,400 people in the camp. The solution is simple, one package to every person. But the Americans voted themselves 7.5 packages each and hoped then that there would be charity. The Japanese were smarter. They just simply took away 100 packages and gave everybody a package. But Yoki observed over and over again that people with privilege, people who have accumulated something, anything, people who have any kind of advantage, do not voluntarily give up that advantage. It seems to me that we are really faced with two alternatives. If we're talking about the whole society, then the only thing that is finally going to force deprivation on us is some kind of overwhelming force. Governmental is a modest one, but just sheer environment, or war, as the example just was. The other alternative is that some sort of redemptive event occurs which makes it possible for us
to see things differently, really to have a new mind on things, to see them differently. That's not education, I think. That's something called repentance or the experience of the gospel, the kind of thing that Al was talking about when he said to go to an ecology meeting was like a religious experience. I probably think it is. I think something like grace has happened in some to these people in order for them to be free for the voluntary giving up. Otherwise it isn't going to happen. It certainly isn't going to happen through education. Our political processes demonstrate that we are not capable in this country of acting in Congress and legislature in our own best interest.
Well, I would only counter in that I think the young are much better prepared to face the future and understand the future. And if we can educate the elementary student, the five-year-old can tell you much more than I can tell you. He tells you that when I grow up, I'm not going to have these things because you're using too much. And this kind of thing that I think can get through. And if we can come to some agreement that we're in a problem situation. Yes, I agree that it's attitude. I agree that it's a need for a whole change in thinking about these things. I agree with you on that.
I'd like to also challenge Walt a little here. There's an important thing that Rudy said that I think went by the wayside. He also pointed out that the natural events in the very near future is one of listing resources. We are not going to be the big producing country. We are, and you recognize that too, I know. But we had here someone quote, I wish I could remember all of it. It was a quote of someone who had told him, or rather it was a story of someone who told him that the man is faced with teaching his children that he will not have economic opportunities that I have in his lifetime, and that's quite true. So what you're saying more or less is, I think, utopian in one sense, you know, unbelievable, is what I'm thinking. And also the governmental pressures and such that you're referring to are going to come through the natural event of our inability to produce, our inability to have as many jobs as we should have for the people of our country. And we will be deprived naturally, of course. I think that's what's very important Rudy was saying, because that's where the education, like the man telling his son, you're not going to be as good as I am, comes in. And I think this is very, very, I think it's a very good way of attacking this problem. Something that's going to come anyway. It's not like we're going to change society and it's going to be status quo and continual growth of GNP. No, sir, it's going to go down in GNP whether you like it or not.
Don't want to break in the midst of that particular good exchange, but I promised at 10:15 we'd take a break. Thank you very much.